Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody, and this is Sorrow Gone Rogue coming back to you. And I need to, before I forget, clarify that I'm on every 2 weeks. I alternate with Dis-Chem, except for last week they needed the slot. But it's every 2 weeks. So the next show will be on the 22nd of July, and the show after that will be the 6th of September. So, August. I'm getting confused. The next show will be on the 6th of August. It's the 22nd of July and the 6th of August. So, you know that I do political stuff, both local and international, but I'm going to start with a story that has absolutely nothing to do with politics. I just heard it on the radio, and it was just a stunning, I didn't know how to react to it. Apparently, a flight instructor on a small plane opened the door of the plane and jumped out. And before he went, he said to his student, his pupil, I guess, "You know what to do." And then he jumped out and killed himself. And the poor woman who was left in the front to guide the plane actually did manage to land properly and safely and got out of it. But I can only assume that the person involved, the person who, the instructor, did so because he wanted to commit suicide or something. But a truly, truly extraordinary story. So there you have it. But back to the things more political. There's been a Pew research study that shows that South Africans have a more favorable view of Israel than people in Europe. And we'll look at that after the break.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Right. Basically, it's Sorrogon here. Hi, 101.9. It's the Sorrogon Rogue Show. And I'm looking at the issue that, according to a survey, South Africans are less, or have a more favorable view, rather, of Israel than people in Europe. The polled opinions on Israel amongst adults across 36 countries and achieved a median of 67% of people. 67% of people having an unfavorable view of the Jewish state, with 25% being favorable. Now, South Africa's views are similar to the average, where 58% of South Africans feel unfavorable towards Israel and 27% are favorable. So it's not exactly a reassuring figure that if South Africa was the best and still virtually double the number of people, you know, have unfavorable views towards Israel, it can only bode ill for the rest. To give you an idea, the percentages of people who view Israel negatively amount to the following: 78% in Sweden and Spain, 76% in Netherlands, 75% in Italy, 73% in Germany, 69% in Britain, 69% in France, and 65% in Greece. And it was only Hungary that had a lower proportion of people who viewed Israel unfavorably, and 54% of Hungarians viewed Israel unfavorably. So that's, we'll take whatever friends we can get, it seems. And remember, this is only a poll done amongst Europeans. In Greece, 30% of people viewed Israel favorably, such as it is, and 32% of Hungarians also did. So how Israel changes its perception when it has been accused officially of genocide by wonderful bodies such as the UN and Amnesty International over something that was not remotely a genocide, I do not honestly know. And we'll need to look at some time as to how it gets counted. Now, further bad news is that over 85% of South African schools are considered dysfunctional. And essentially they're saying the public education system has collapsed over the past decade. And this is to be contrasted against the 15% of schools that are considered amongst the best in the world. And obviously it's dominated by private schools and former Model C public schools. It's become entrenched rather than diminished by the ANC-led government since it came into power in 1994. So access to education has greatly increased, but the deterioration means that many students who finish matric and need to study further to become more productive members of society. Essentially, a vicious cycle has been created where the productivity of labor in South Africa has stagnated, and it drags down economic growth, which we know is the set of policies that really have to make a difference to employment and improving people's quality of life. And it's just the resources that are needed to be invested in education have been limited. Azar Jameen, the economist, has said that the way that poor basic education shows up in the data is that much of the youth does not study in areas where jobs are being created and are really needed. He says this is going to become even more critical in the years to come, particularly as the economy becomes increasingly digital, maths-based, and computer-based. And as I said, 85% of South African schools are largely dysfunctional. And this means that 24,000 schools across South Africa, only 4,000 of those schools are really effective at creating skilled individuals. South Africa actually spends a significant share of its budget on education, so it consumes around 6% of the country's GDP on a regular basis. So we're spending more money than many countries on our education, and we're getting a lousy result. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, much of the money is actually spent on administrative staff within government departments and across the country and provincial departments, rather than on teachers and educational material. So it's, again, perhaps the only place that jobs are being created in this country is in government. The challenge that South Africa's education system faces is the rapid rise in access to education without the increased capacity and investment in the classrooms. Quality has declined as a result, with pupils entering school without access to good teaching, textbook, and facilities. And particularly, as mentioned, in the particularly necessary field of needing good quality maths and science education, which is vital for a modern economy and an economy that grows. While grade R enrollment, which is the first stage of the education process, has risen by 222% in the past 25 years, that's the number of kids going into school at the first stage, only 63% of pupils who enter school actually finish matric. And this essentially means that the outcome means that just 4 in 10 scholars who write matric are actually gaining a university entrance pass. And of course the problem with that is if those who gain a pass and go to university are then studying subjects that have no value to the broader economy, and potentially leaves matriculants who should have great potential unemployed. Basically, it's considered a huge achievement that 80% of school children in South Africa are at no free schools. So the access to schooling has been very positive in that regard. But the lack of fees affect the subjects that need to be taught. And apparently this also includes an absence of discipline. And discipline is crucial in schools because, you know, without discipline, teaching doesn't happen or teaching struggles to happen. And children who want to be taught and want the education and background do not get what they do not necessarily get what they need, or it's very poor. So that's a worrying and fundamental aspect of school life for South Africa and the impact on employment and the development of the economy.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Well, today we are looking at an interview with an old colleague of mine and a frequent appearer on Chai FM, Terence Corrigan, who is the Project and Publications Manager at the Institute of Race Relations. Terence, welcome.
Hi, Zara. How are you?
Okay, I'm good, and you?
Cold, but surviving.
Good, good. We're going to look at the subject of what is the issue that you dealt with in a column earlier this week, which is dubbed voter hubris, which is very, very intriguing. And what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, is just give a lead in about voting and how you develop the right to vote, and particularly with relevance to possibly one of the most important elections, which will actually be a local election on the 4th of November of this year. I mean, our municipalities are in crisis, not least of all the municipality of Johannesburg, which is the biggest and most important city in South Africa economically. Now, the crux is that voter literacy is the problem, and there's ignorance of the reason to vote, and it's fundamental. Now, the Section 19 is a constitutional right, says that every adult children has the right to vote in elections for any legislative body and to do so in secret. Now, the problem is that we've tended to regard voting in elections not a right, but rather a civic duty, which probably amounts to the same in the end. And not voting, I would argue, would be to some extent the dereliction of the responsibilities of citizenship. Now, the right to vote also implies the right not to vote. But the critical thing about voting is it's the one moment in every South African's life who is of an age that they can register and vote is absolute equality. Every person has one vote, and no one's vote counts more than anybody else. It's the most equal action and fundamental to democracy, and it's actually an awesome power. And what you have a problem with is people electing not to vote. If you have a multiple effect of thousands of people not voting, it could have serious implications for the outcome of the election. It also means that non-voters are subject to politicians that they didn't vote for. Only those who voted for it are re-elected. And I would say that non-voters can't complain about the result. Terence, just before you go on to voter hubris, do you have any comments on the general background that I've set out?
Let me just say that I would go further. I would say this isn't about democracy as much as about citizenship. And we often, you know, misunderstand that by conflating citizenship with nationality. In other words, it's your right to have a passport. Citizenship is actually a kind of it's what we call in junior school an action word. Mm-hmm. It's about you taking responsibility for your society and acting as a person engaged in your society. You know, it's for that reason I think, you know, some of the rituals around voting are very important. I'm not a great fan of things like electronic voting or mail-in ballots or whatever. It's been a big issue in America. I think there is actually something to be said for spending 2 hours in a queue with your fellow citizens as you snake towards, you know, your 2 minutes from the, you know, in the voting booth. You know, it's a it's a kind of ritual that says, I am part of the society. I am making a essentially symbolic sacrifice to be here. For some people, it's a real sacrifice. And I am taking active, visible charge of the country. Democracy is an important state of citizenship. And historically, it's been a vanishingly rare thing that that a population can actually change their government by a vote. You know, often it's by divine right, you know, a new king, or it's because there's been a revolution and lots of people have died. It's a sort of wonder of intellectual and conceptual evolution that you can actually go do this peacefully, and your government will either continue or gracefully exit.
Well, I think
so. Don't underestimate the importance of that.
No, I think it's basically a morning or a couple of hours spent. Very, very seldom to do something that fundamental. I mean, it's not as if anyone has to embark on a whole series of activities over time to cast a vote. It really is.
Mm.
It just takes a little bit of time periodically.
Right. Absolutely.
So what when you're talking about voter hubris, which is a fascinating concept, what are you talking about?
Well, there's a number of things. It's the but what concerns me is the idea that there is a kind of mindset that I think has gained traction in South Africa, that somehow we're not being governed well,
mm-hmm.
and that is because we have the wrong leaders, and mm-hmm. we need new leaders, but there doesn't seem to always be this sort of connection. Well, you know, those leaders are there because citizens had agency and put them there.
Mm.
There's enormous gnashing of teeth. People remember the Zuma era.
Mm.
But let's remember, Jacob Zuma was an extremely popular leader for a long time. Even today, he maintains a sizable following.
Mm.
And I think there's a tendency to point fingers at these corrupt politicians and whatever. But you know, as citizens collectively and individually, we had the capacity to change that.
Hmm.
So when we see the problems of leadership enduring in South Africa, we need to ask not why do we have we need to ask why we have bad leaders, but not what is wrong with these leaders, but also what is wrong with these followers that allowed it.
Hmm. No, well, I think you described it as essentially what happens is you're casting a vote on personal grounds. It's a visceral reaction, and that's why one of the problems has been, and I think the ANC has in the last few years stayed in power for longer than we think is warranted, is that people are voting for the ANC as a visceral reaction, but they're voting for them for the wrong reason. They're voting for them not because they don't want change, but they believe that if they vote for them, they are indicating that they're giving the opportunity to a party like the ANC to do better.
Sure. Right.
And that, you know, it may work out sometimes, but you know, after a few elections, when the situation in the country has got worse, a time may be reached that you have to change who you vote for in order to get a better result, because you can't rely on a better result from the incumbent party.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, the spark for writing that article was a comment by a Facebook user who said that, you know, he couldn't possibly vote for the DA in Johannesburg because Helen Zille is so unlikable. And are you saying voter hubris is the problem? I'm saying, well, yes, voter hubris is the problem, and in a way, that is as it should be in a democracy. Voters can, you know, the choices voters make have meaningful outcomes. Now, the ANC, I think that it's important to kind of segment this. I would say that you know, the political and governmental malaise we are in, you know, is traced to many of the choices that the ANC made. And this goes back to the 1990s. But I do think that there are people who can make a rational choice in favor of the ANC. If you think about things like social grants, for instance, I mean, those would be very important. Where I find the hubris, let's say, particularly jarring is, you know, amongst well-heeled suburbanites who feel that, you know, either nothing will ever change and, you know, let's just have a bribe, or who can maybe indulge in these luxury beliefs. Oh, you know, I hate the ANC. The ANC has ruined Joburg, but, I can't possibly vote for someone as unlikable as Helen Ziller. Well, you know, that sort of vibes politics, as I say, is a luxury belief. And I think that that we are now at a point where the responsibilities of citizenship call on all of us to seriously assess what is the outcome you want. Not, you know, what gives you a warm and tingly feeling.
Yes.
And as I say, this to my mind seems to be a suburban rather than a township phenomenon.
Well, essentially, what I think you said it, that what essentially people are doing, and particularly as you say in the group mentioned, is that they're sort of looking for perfection in their choice of public representatives. And I think worldwide, I mean, we've seen it with, let's say, Donald Trump, Keir Starmer, et cetera, that A, perfection is not achievable. B, the sort of people you may want in politics don't go into politics because they have a more lucrative or creative things to do. So there's that element. So you essentially, your choices of perfection become fairly limited. So at the end of the day, you're really only looking at the best in the circumstances.
Sure.
And they may be imperfect options, but it's incumbent on the voter to get a sense of what those options are. And those people who may not like Helen Ziller, her track record and the record of the Western Cape governance in general is streets ahead in many respects as any alternative.
Sure. Right. Yeah. Look, I think it was Aristotle who said something about as human beings, we need politics because we are not gods. We don't need it. And we are not beasts who are not capable of engaging it. So yes, you know, the idea that a messiah is going to arise from the dusty streets and, you know, be everything you want is not achievable. You know, if we were a prosperous society and had well functioning institutions, whatever, that, you know, politics would perhaps be something that that we could treat as little game people play and, you know, not bother to show up. An acquaintance of mine who spent some years in the United States said he met a lot of very nice, decent people who had never voted for a presidential election simply because they were very focused on their community. And they weren't particularly concerned about who was in the White House. I don't think that is a responsible option for South Africa at its present juncture.
Interestingly, as you say, you talked about, you know, it particularly being a problem amongst, say, middle class suburbanites, and I think one of the problems is that South Africans, being who they are and just getting on and making a plan, have become, in many respects, perhaps used to getting together as citizens in their communities and fixing things like potholes and sidewalks and other things that need cleaning or mowing, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, you know, they come with an attitude of, well, you know, I'm doing it. So, you know, and the government or the politicians have not done it for me. So there's no point in voting for them. But I would have thought it's worthwhile voting because you want to try and, A, get politicians who will do something, and B, perhaps politicians who make, you know, work hard enough and efficiently enough to make sure you don't have to do it yourself, that your rates are covering the work done.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think that particularly in an urban setting, there's really no getting away from the fact that you need some form of government.
Mm.
Out in the rural sticks, it's a little different. There's a limit to what government in a very dispersed community can do.
Mm.
But you know, my response to that is even if you are taking nothing from the municipality is still demanding a great deal from you. Sort of dare you not to pay your rates and your rates and services for an extended period. And certainly not if you are not in a kind of politically sensitive area where you know, the government might be inclined to back off.
Mm.
Once again, this is suburbia. That being said, even with the best people in the world at the helm, the damage to the state and the extent of the needs of society are such that we are going to need a great deal more citizen engagement going forward.
Mm.
And while I have mixed feelings about a group like AfriForum, I think this is a model that they've pioneered very very effectively. Mm. And I also note, this is very anecdotal, but just a trawling through Facebook, you see a lot of people who are, you know, shall we put it delicately, not in AfriForum's natural constituents, who view this as a sort of model for many other for many other constituencies.
Mm. Mm. Just to go back I just want to go back a little just to make the point with regard to middle class voters not voting. Apparently, one of the big problems is that people in gated communities, I think irrespective of whether they're involved in trying to correct problems in their area, but gated communities are not voting. Now, this is very worrying because obviously there are a fair number of gated communities with a fair number of people living in them, and you know, collectively, countrywide, their vote could make a difference. Is it that sense of seclusion that of being self-reliant that's dictating their choice not to vote?
I can't speak to the voting behavior of those communities, but I do know that it has been a perennial problem with political parties trying to canvass.
Mm.
Gated communities essentially stand outside that kind of door to door, you know, door knocking. Or, you know, are you going to vote for party X, Y, Z?
Mm.
Because you just can't get access.
Mm.
I think also the gated community is kind of both a signifier of self-reliance, but also a kind of resignation to South Africa's decline.
Mm. Mm.
People, I think, move into them in the first instance because of safety concerns, but also because there's a sense that within these four walls, or however many walls there are, you live in your own little bubble. You don't have to look at the decay and the awfulness outside.
Mm, mm.
With the rise of things like online working and being able to sell high-tech skills all around the world, there's a sense in which some people may feel that they can essentially resign from South African public life.
Mm.
And to some extent, that may be a reassuring thing.
Mm.
Something else I said in my article is that for many in the country's middle class, what enables luxury beliefs is the sense that you can buy yourself out of the worst features of state failure, and you can provide your kids with the sort of escape hatch of immigration.
Mm.
And I rather get the sense that people who talk the sort of language the loudest are those with the most career mobility.
Mm. No,
and,
of course,
you know, are likely to preface their posts with, "Well, when I was living in London, and when I last visited New York, and whatever." And my, you know, my daughter just put in an application to Columbia University. Now, those are things that are those are options that are not available to most to most South Africans. I would, however, say that you pay an awful cost for that, and I would say society pays an awful cost for that. I understand the motivation, and I am not one to judge, but I do say that unless you are going to ultimately physically remove yourself from the country, what happens within the country's borders and within the delimitations of your municipality, you cannot escape it. You cannot escape it entirely.
Yeah, well, I think, and just to wrap up, I think essentially you have to accept that you may not be interested in politics, but politics is sure interested in you. And you know, I could only really plead with people to go out and vote. It takes very little time, and it could make all the difference. You know, think wisely, think practically, because you've really got to. Do what you think is good for you. That's what why you're entitled to vote. What other people want or what they want to do is irrelevant. Terence, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I'm sure we'll see you soon on another.
Always a great pleasure.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
A serious problem that we face, particularly given the level of corruption and criminality in this country, is that there has been what has been described as a mass exodus of experienced prosecutors at our National Prosecuting Authority. Now, what the NPA has done has entered into lucrative early retirement agreements with senior prosecutors, and this has resulted in the departure of 47 experienced prosecution staff members as at the end of April 2026. Now, you know, I couldn't find why this has been done, why these offers have been made, because these are the people you want to keep, irrespective of which demographic in country they come from, because this represents almost the entire complement of truly experienced prosecutors at the NPA. Now, Glynis Breitenbach, that doughty spokesperson for the DA on Justice and Constitutional Development, has described the situation as deeply concerning. She says the circumstances surrounding these departments raise serious questions about both the judgment and the governance of the NPA's leadership. It's alleged that these early retirement packages were approved without the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development's consent. And as Breitenbach says, if true, this would represent a serious breach of government and a blatant disregard for established oversight mechanisms. And so why the NPA would do that is so questionable. I mean, in an area where you need considerable expertise, and the prosecuting of criminal cases is not a simple matter. It requires people who have substantial legal education, and it just basically makes no sense. And I mean, it's understood that South Africa's problem is not an excess of experienced prosecutors. I'm not sure you can have an excess of experienced prosecutors. But as Breitenbach said, the exact opposite is true. Now, the NPA has cited things like capacity constraints, skills shortage, overwhelming caseloads, and the complexity of corruption prosecutions for its poor performance. Its inability to secure convictions against those responsible for state capture and large-scale corruption is particularly notable. So you would think that what the NPA should be doing is paying people to encourage them to stay, when perhaps for all those reasons given, it might be very tempting to employ it might be very tempting to employ more prosecutors. And it's the same applies in any department or any business, that your senior people, there's only a limit to how much you can make space for junior people. Because without those senior people to instruct and encourage and have an influence on the youth, one thing you don't get is whatever you learned at university and in the legal sphere, and the same goes for every other, is never what you is really fairly remote to what you actually do on the job. And the only people you can do that successfully through is being mentored by people who actually have experience. So it essentially seems to me that instead of, as I say, paying for them to encourage them to stay, by paying for them to take voluntary packages is just beyond comprehension. It just really, really doesn't make sense. Now, going back to the to a subject that we've tackled on a number of occasions, is black economic empowerment. The government has now proposed laws for petrol stations on South Africa's national roads. Now, it has produced SANRAL, the South African National Roads Agency, have produced draft legislative proposals which will impose new broad-based black economic empowerment requirements for petrol stations and other roadside businesses. Now, in reality, I would have thought that petrol stations would have no problem with naturally meeting BEE requirements, because so much of the staff, not least of which are the attendants who attend to providing you with petrol and other things, are largely black. So I'm not quite sure why this doubling down on BEE is seen as such a necessity. What the policy essentially does is it wants to regulate developments such as petrol stations, truck shops, restaurants, convenience stores, and infrastructure related to electric vehicle or alternative fuels. And it wants to control businesses that operate on private land. What they would do is, in the draft policies, they give SANRAL sweeping powers to dictate who can operate a business along a national road, setting transformation credential requirements, imposing levies, and mandating how businesses must be structured. And again, this is irrespective of whether the business operates on privately owned land, and even if it has no contractual relationship with SANRAL. Now, according to Sakalicha, the NGO, the agency is relying on sections of the SANRAL Act that were intended to regulate access to national roads for road safety and traffic purposes only. And they're now using these provisions to introduce much broader commercial and social regulations. The point being made is that SANRAL is not an economic regulator or a license authority for private businesses, and should not be empowered to impose transformation requirements on private landowners.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Just going on the theme of professionals quitting important institutions, a national report by the Governing Body Foundation has shown that uncoordinated compliance demands and constant last-minute deadlines are driving an unprecedented retrenchment crisis amongst veteran school teachers. Again, the similar thing to the NPA. They're essentially buried under a mountain of compliance templates and duplicate financial spreadsheets and last-minute departmental reporting forms. Now, I was involved in the governing bodies of my children's primary school and high school, and I saw this phenomenon repeated often and really giving school principals an absolute headache and taking away from the fundamental functions that teachers and principals are required to expose themselves, are being exposed to, at the expense of staff support, things like learner engagement and school improvement education. the overload is what is causing this desire to leave their profession. So now we're looking at another thing of possibly having good, experienced, well-qualified teachers leaving because they just can't stand the extra load on them in the form of administration. And, you know, they want a life. They don't want to spend evenings and weekends doing administration that probably doesn't need doing. And I know from my experience that the that, you know, they would often be required to meet with the officials on short notice, and that there was really a disregard for the pressures imposed on principals and school teachers that are really not sure are needed at all. And as we mentioned in one of the earlier subjects we dealt with, the employment crisis in South African schools is largely a result of the fact that the money we spend on hiring people goes to administrative staff, not to teachers. So it seems like we're doing everything to shoot ourselves in the foot at an increasing level. And they say, and this is my final point on it, that this issue, this problem is actually not limited to understaffed and underfunded schools. It's the sample taken by the Governing Body Foundation also represents the wealthiest, largest public schools in the country. So we've got another, it's layers and layers of bureaucracy and demands that this country doesn't really need. Well, that's me for this week. As I say, just to remind you that I'm on every 2 weeks alternating with Dis-Chem, so the next time I'll be on the air is on the 22nd of July. So this is Sorogon signing off, and just say you can see more of what I periodically write on my Substack, which is sora281.substack.com, and I deal with sometimes a very different range of subjects. So feel free, please, to go to it. Otherwise, I'll see you on Chai FM 101.9, and it'll be in 2 weeks' time. Be well in the meantime, and, do not let the cold get to you. The sun always shines, at least.